I'm going to introduce Christopher Arrico. He is a physician assistant in the Department of Dermatology at the DuPage Medical Group in Naperville, Illinois. Chris graduated with his Bachelor of Science in Molecular Biology and Microbiology at the University of Central Florida. Go Knights, I'm from there too. And that was in 2005. And with his Master of Science in Physician Assistant Practice at Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science in 2007. He takes special interest in chronic inflammatory dermatologic diseases and has lectured nationwide on these topics. He also is an active member of the SDPA. Please give a warm welcome to Chris Arrico.
Good afternoon, everyone. I know this is a 3 o'clock time slot on the third day of a conference. I'm very well aware of that. So we're going to try to make this as interesting as possible, I promise. Also, I'm Italian. I like to gesticulate with my hands. And if I move too far out of the microphone, you know, wavelength, just throw something at me and tell me to go where it is, okay? Thank you all so much for coming this afternoon. Little fun fact about LA. LA is home to one of the biggest fossil sites in the country, let alone the world. It's called the La Brea Tar Pits. Anybody familiar with that? No, have ever heard of it before? So it's actually not that far from here. It's about 7 miles, but in LA traffic, that's probably about an hour and a half. One thing that can, you know, has happened with this is that they've found all these fossils, you know, wrapped in tar for all these years. So you may have heard of La Brea tar pits, and they went down, Bob and Francine, two more victims of La Brea carpets. So my father is a retired biology high school teacher, and he would open up every single class with one of these far sides. So I figured I needed to like carry that tradition on a little bit. But actually, what does this have to do with dermatology, right? There is actually a slight correlation. And the correlation is that one of the first effective treatments for psoriasis was Geckerman treatment. And if anybody knows what Geckerman is, it is actually a really horrible process of wrapping people in coal tar and mummifying them for sometimes days on end. In hospital wings. And this was something that happened as up until the 80s. So it's right when I was born. The fact that we were using this treatment only about 40 years ago, and the fact that now we have medications that actually bring us to some of the people 100% clear with every 3 month injection or, you know, every 8 week injection is really, really amazing. That's something that is really just mind boggling, going from mummification to, you know, something like that. So we're going to talk about biologics today. We're going to talk about specifically kind of understanding biologics and when they kind of go awry, what exactly do we do? I do speak for both AbbVie and Sanofi, Genzyme and Regeneron. That's my only disclosures. Okay, here's those response questions. And these are just general questions about your own practice. So the first one says basically, if you see a brand new psoriasis patient and they have moderate plaque psoriasis to the scalp, trunk, elbows, knees, lower legs with a TBSA of about 10, what's your time frame for actually starting a biologic? Is it after the first month, within 1 month, within 6 months, or is it never? I'll give you a second to kind of put that in your phone. And there's three of these, so I'll tell you what I do after the third one. All right, so right at the first. I mean, actually, I think that's exactly what I would do. You know, especially with that 10% body surface area, there really is an indication for these patients to be on a biologic by that point. The second question would be, how long do you wait to see a patient back after starting a new biologic regimen? Is it 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, or just a year? All right, gonna go forward. About 1 or 3 months. That's also very realistic. What I do is I'm a nerd. I like to see patients back and follow the kind of the product insert and kind of exactly where patients fall in need for follow-up. So I kind of want to see that PASI improvement happen kind of real time. So I will see a patient back at 1 month, actually at 3 months, at six months, and then every 6 months after that. Usually you will pick up side effects within the first month to 3 months or so if they are going to have any adverse events. So it's always good to kind of see them early, but even 6 months is reasonable. I have patients, they get clear really quickly on their biologics, and I don't see them for 6 months to a year, which I yell at them about, but it happens. I mean, these medications are super effective. And this is the last question. It says, if your patient is currently on a biologic but have either not seen enough improvement or are seeing a worsening of their symptoms, how long do you wait before finding a new treatment option? Within a month is the most common answer. Second would be 6 months, and then third would be 3 months. Actually, now third is three change positions. So what I do is when I'm starting a patient on a biologic, I tell them that you're on this journey with me for 6 months. And that usually kind of puts in their head that, okay, I can do anything for 6 months. And that's also a good question that we get all the time about, you know, how long do I have to be on this medication for? I say, we're going to be on it for 6 months together, and then we're going to go from there. And usually that they can chunk that block of time out in their mind, and it's like, okay, that I can do. So, but rules are meant to be broken. And you're going to see with some of the cases that I have, we've had to break those rules with some people for certain reasons, and we'll go through some of that. Okay. Case one that I have is, this is Kelly. These are both actual patients of mine. This woman is a 36-year-old female, and this was kind of her sample, kind of small plaque psoriasis that she had. She had her baseline psoriasis when she showed up to me was in April of 2016. Small plaque type psoriasis, about 9% total body surface area, and she had a PGA of about 3. So more of a moderate type of plaque psoriasis. She had no PSA symptoms or signs. She did have skin involvement to the scalp, upper and lower extremities, trunk and back. But actually, she was kind of a unicorn. She had an overall really good health status, no chronic comorbidities, BMI of 24, and non-smoker. I mean, how often do you see a psoriasis patient like that? Very, very unusual. But she was bothered by her psoriasis, and she had enough body surface area to indicate that she went on a biologic. And so we started her on adalimumab in 2016, and she really cleared very nicely to 95% improvement through early 2019. In May of 2019, she came back to my clinic, and she had a really significant guttate flare, which is something that obviously we see a lot of and we'll kind of talk about. But it was about 40% of her surface area. And when you have somebody who comes in with a guttate flare like that, they're very much in distress. They've had really clear psoriasis for this whole amount of time. They're already on a biologic. They think they're pretty much invincible, but now they're having these issues. So I started to actually ask her some questions. I'm like, you know, in the last 8 weeks, have you had any sore throats? Have you had any fevers? Have you had any ear infections, any skin rashes, anything like that? And she said, you know, come to think of it, I did have a little bit of a sore throat and about 4 weeks ago. So I ran an anti-streptolysin titer, and sure enough, it was positive. This was kind of like a picture, you know, similar picture to what her guttate flare looked like. So she had a strep-induced guttate psoriasis flare. I started her on doxycycline, 100 milligrams, BID for 8 weeks. Also triamcinolone, basically BID for 2 weeks, holding for 2 weeks, kind of a cycle on and off like that for 8 weeks total. And then she also was continuing her adalimumab. At 8 week follow-up, her guttate flare was clear, but she did have some PIH. Okay, so what happens when these patients flare? this is not easy. They've come to us, and we've put, you know, so much faith in these biologic medications that they're going to work so well, and we promise them the world and everything, and then they flare up. And it's like, oh, my goodness, what do we do? What do we do next? So the most common cause of psoriasis flare is infection, especially strep. Strep has a has really bad toxin pathways that can actually really induce psoriasis for a lot of people, and that can make a huge difference in, you know, in their overall health. It can cause a guttate flare, but also it doesn't just have to be a pharyngeal infection. It can actually be impetigo, can also be otitis. Bronchitis is not usually strep, but any infection can do this, including bronchitis and tonsillitis. They can have other respiratory infections. And incidentally, as I was looking through literature writing this, I did read about people getting vaccines, and specifically COVID-19 vaccines, and actually having a flare of their psoriasis, which kind of makes sense, right? Basically, anytime you're upregulating the immune system in any way, people are going to have more cytokine activity. That cytokine activity could lead to them having a lot more inflammation overall. Obviously, we want to be encouraging our patients to get COVID-19 vaccines, so this is just some incidental stuff. But you might want to just tell them, hey, you know, even though you can get the vaccine during this time, you may flare a little bit. Some other medications that can actually cause flare are beta blockers. Beta blockers are one of the most common medications, actually, that you actually cause flare. Beta blockers, they don't quite understand the rationale behind that, but it kind of has something to do with the inflammatory pathway that kind of controls both cytokine activity and beta blocker activity. Other medications can actually cause this as well. NSAIDs are another big one. Anxiolytic medications, antimalarials, antiarrhythmics, and lithium. We see lithium on all these lists because it seems to be kind of a rough drug. Couple other things that can cause flares. Psychological stress. I don't know about you guys, but I have seen more stressed out patients in the last year and a half than ever in the 14 years of practice that I've had. And that's including myself. This has been a stressful year and a half for all of us. And really, it means that patients' inflammatory skin conditions, including psoriasis, are worsening. And so I used to kind of tiptoe around the stress talk with patients. I used to say, you know, should I be asking about that? Is that really my business? I don't care anymore. I'm old enough that I just say, tell me about your life. Are you having any issues at home? Are you having any stress in your life? And you know what? Almost all of them say that they do. Everybody has stress, but people manage it in different ways. I have a stack of referral cards for somebody's also having some stress outside. So I have a stack of referral cards for therapists in my area, and I hand them out like candy. I'm a big fan of therapy, and honestly, it really makes a big difference in their skin disease, so why not help them kind of get through both things at the same time? Physical stress can make a big difference as well. Patients who have to go through surgeries, who have to go through any type of hospitalization, that can put a big stress on their body and their mind itself, which can cause inflammatory issues. Physical traumas also. This is a picture of Kebnerization here on the right. It's kind of a cool picture. You can see that this patient has a history of psoriasis. You can see where they were scratching because of, you know, probably some itch associated with psoriasis. And they have these really linear kind of plaques that are happening there. It's definitely something that we see. It's a known phenomenon. Smoking can make anything worse, including psoriasis, so we want to be helping our patients to do some smoking cessation. And then cold weather. I make a joke to my patients that I'm happy to write them a note to tell them that they have to move, because Chicago is a really cold place for about 6 months out of the year. Cold weather doesn't do any good things for their psoriasis. Okay, this is my second patient. This is Deborah. Deborah is a 63-year-old female. She came to me because she was having pretty significant psoriasis, joint pain symptoms, but really what brought her in was the fact that she was having fissuring on her palms and her soles. She works as a bartender, so she had to be on her feet all night, and then she also had to have her hands in and out of water during those shifts. Both of those things are really bad for palmar plantar psoriasis. But she also had plaque-type psoriasis on her elbows, knees, scalp, about 11% total body surface area, PGA of 4, so pretty severe. And she also reported joint symptoms. So now we have to kind of be working this up a little bit. You have to ask those questions about, you know, are you having joint symptoms first thing in the morning? How long are they lasting for? All of that stuff. And basically, I was feeling her joints, and I felt some nodularity kind of on her fingers. She didn't have any deviations at that time, but it still was a little bit iffy for her. And she really said she was actually feeling a lot of pain. So I did send her right away. I was like, you know, it's going to take a couple months to get in to see a rheumatologist, make that appointment, and then, you know, we can kind of continue with our care here. But as soon as you see them, they might adjust a couple things. So her overall health status was, she has a history of diabetes, she had a BMI of 36, former 2-pack-per-day smoker. I did send her over to rheumatology, she ended up having being diagnosed with psoriatic arthritis based on her joint erosion on x-ray. She had about moderate joint erosion, both in her hands and her feet. So right at the first visit, I had decided to get her started on adalimumab. So 2017, we got her started, and when I saw her for her first follow-up visit, which happened to be January of 18, she only had about 50% skin improvement, but, you know, that's still, it's about 8 weeks, so that could be within the realm of normal. She did have significant pain reduction to her joints, but she had no improvement to her palmar plantar lesions. And remember, that's kind of what brought her into me, is she had really bad palmar plantar psoriasis. In April of 2018, she came back in and not a whole lot had changed from the January visit. So we decided then, it had been about 5 months, but I'm like, you know, it might be time to kind of stop this and move on to something else. So we decided to stop the adalimumab and start secukinumab, just because she was not really improving. And at the July 18 follow-up, she had no improvement in her skin and joints, no improvement to her joints, worsening joint pain, no improvement to her skin. So unfortunately, it was a full strikeout on the second medication. And now she's getting irritated because she's been on these medications for close to 9 months now, and she's very nice, but she's also being a little forceful with me and saying, you promised me the world here. And I'm like, I know, I'm sorry. Let's see what we need to do. So. I didn't do the usual 6 months, especially because of her joint pain. I was not going to make her go through another, you know, 3 months worth of medication. So we stopped that right away and started her on etanercept. October 2018, while on etanercept, she reached 80% improvement with almost complete clearance to her hands, feet, and body areas. Scalp lesions improved from about a 4 to a 2. And she's maintained that clearance till today. What a wild ride, right? But these are patients that we see. This is exactly what we would see on a normal basis. And sometimes it feels like we're throwing darts at dartboards. And that's why I think it's important that we can kind of look at this and say, what exactly can we do for them? Why did the first anti-TNF medication not work? And why did the second work? You know. And so I think there's still a lot of research that will continue to be done with this. But maybe we can help guide a little bit. So these are the epic fails. And just like what's going to happen with that poor convertible, that's going to be bad for them. So what is biologic failure? Biologic failure is really something that has not been defined well in the US. A European consensus defined treatment success as a PASI improvement of at least 75%, while an intermediate response was improvement between 50 and 74%. So basically, to get any even intermediate response, you had to have 50% or more. Success was 75% or more. So failure is anything below 50, basically, according to European studies. There's a couple different types of failures. We have patients who just fully do not respond at all and just do not have any primary lack of efficacy. So basically, they don't have any improvement at all right out of the gate. And that would have been my secukinumab trial with that patient. They can also have paradoxical worsening of their psoriasis. They basically can have psoriasiform symptoms that actually start while they're on specific medications. And that is really tough. This tends to happen in patients who have RA and IBD. And it tends to be more female rather than males. It could be in a TNF class effect. And there's some studies that have come out about this. And then the role of interferon alpha has been kind of questioned as well. Patients who are on interferon for hepatitis C as well as IBD and also for MS, this can sometimes actually worsen their already bad psoriasis symptoms. Then, so that's all the primary failure stuff. The secondary failures would be actually just loss of efficacy over time. So that means, and we can see this right out of the gate with some of the 52-week studies, if you look through of the PIs of the, 12 to 54,000 biologics we have now for psoriasis, which is a good thing. I'm not saying it's bad. But if you look in the PI, you can actually see, after 16 weeks, especially after induction, some biologics are losing efficacy a little bit. And they tend to trail down a little bit slower, over time. And that can be tough for patients. During induction, they do super well, and then all of a sudden, they're not doing as well. And why does that happen? They think that there's some neutralizing antibody formation that can happen with some medications, specifically the TNF medications. Autoantibody formation, which can trigger further autoimmunity. So you're giving them a protein that's actually going to help them kind of manage their symptoms, but actually it could be causing further autoantibody formation in their own body. And that can actually trigger new autoimmunity. They could, only have psoriasis when you first see them, but now they have Crohn's or ulcerative colitis or other types of autoimmune issues. Suboptimal dosing. I think these last two are kind of at the same thing. You've given Gary his adalimumab, and he's used 3 pens, and it's now 6 months later, and he's wondering why he's not improving. And the reality is that Gary is not using his medication appropriately, and his therapeutic dosing is not where it should be, basically. So we need to kind of help those patients actually get on medication correctly. Okay, this is why you guys are here. How do we do this? What do we do to fix this? So there's a lot that you can do, and basically, you should ask yourself is, am I going to stay within the same class of biologics, or am I going to switch to a different class? And the second thing is therapeutic drug monitoring something that we can look into? I've started to do this a little bit with some of my patients, and it's become pretty helpful, actually. And basically LabCorp, who happens to be the lab that we work with in my group, they have assays specifically for the biologic medications. And I'm going to kind of show you a really great flowchart that they came up with, actually. So they can check with the optimal dosing, they look at trough levels, and they can also look at any drug antibody formation. Excuse me. The second question you should be asking yourself is, has the patient comorbidities changed since you're starting any biologics? Do they have any new diagnoses of ulcerative colitis or Crohn's? Any worsening CHF? Any tinea infections while on the previous class of medications? And then another big question in that category is, do they have any new psoriatic arthritis symptoms? Or maybe it was just being masked and it wasn't being taken care of enough. And then the last question would be, how close were they to reaching improvement? So Deborah, my second patient, she reached about 50% improvement on adalimumab, and her joint symptoms got better. So we know that the TNF class worked for her, but it just didn't work to the degree it should have. So, you know, that's why maybe keeping within that class is maybe a good idea for Deborah. This is pretty great. This is actually on the LabCorp website, and this is actually their decision tree for treating patients. This is patients with RA, though, on biologic medications. And I'm going to actually start on the right, and then we'll kind of go to the left and then the center. So if you have a patient whose free drug trough level is subtherapeutic, let me just break that down, basically saying that the free drug in their body is not where it should be. It means there's not enough medication in their system. And their anti-drug antibodies are either or undetectable or low. It just means that they don't have enough drug in their system. So it means that you should maximize the dose, you know, try to get them back onto their regimens as much as possible. And hopefully we can kind of get them to where they want to be improvement-wise and where we want them to be. If the free drug trough level, meaning that if the free drug trough level or the drug in their system is at or above target at 12 months and they don't have any anti-drug antibodies, they're at the adequate dose. Call it a day, keep them where they are. They probably don't need to be moved. Going all the way to the left here, if you have a patient whose drug levels are low and they have no anti-drug antibodies, kind of the same thing as that good response. Their dose needs to be increased. They're probably not taking their medication as directed, or for some reason there are patients that do not do well on a specific medication, or their metabolism is actually metabolizing it out too quickly for them. The second column on the left is anti-drug antibodies are low to intermediate. So they have low drug levels, but they also have a little bit higher antibody levels for drug. This could be a reversible immunogenicity. So they already have a little bit of some levels that are coming up there, and it could just mean that they need a little more drug to overcome some of those neutralizing antibodies, or you can add methotrexate. That's a way to sometimes neutralize those extra antibodies. If they have low levels of drug and their anti-drug antibodies are high, they basically have a late refractory period, and it could mean that they actually need to come off of their specific medication that you're on and consider switching within the class. Basically, that means that for some reason the antibodies have actually been built up for this particular medication, but it doesn't mean it for the class overall. The last column here basically says free drug levels are at, they're optimized, so you actually have them at the levels that they should, but their anti-drug antibody is actually low and the patient is still not doing well. That's actually a pharmacodynamic or kind of mechanistic failure. It means that for some reason those binding sites are not working well together, and that's when you actually should consider switching biologics out of class. And that means that patients probably need to move completely separately out of that class. This is actually also from the LabCorp website. This is the actual tests and the test codes for these medications. So you can actually order this. If you use LabCorp, you can actually order these specifically. I have no affiliation with LabCorp also, just letting you know, but this is very helpful. And these are the medications currently on their list. So you've done your decision tree and things are still not working. You have a patient that has been on this biologic for a little while now, and you just cannot seem to get them as clear as you want them to be, and you don't really want to move them out of their classes or move them off of that drug. So what do? A cheap, pretty inexpensive option is adding UVB. The previous lecture that we were on with Dr. I'm going to get his name wrong. It's Zirkus? No. Zyrus, sorry. I'm sorry, Dr. Zyrus. He had some great tips about using tanning beds. I'm a little kind of scared, so I'm not sure I can do it. But honestly, like sometimes, you know, if you can't get them into a UVB clinic, sometimes that needs to happen. You also have to make sure you're counseling patients about skin cancer risk, of course. Add methotrexate. Methotrexate definitely works better for joints than it does for skin. But if you have patients who are doing well skin-wise, their joints are not as controlled, maybe that's the right option for you. Adding cyclosporin. Cyclosporin, unfortunately, has a bunch of possible side effects, as does methotrexate. You have to do blood monitoring, and also you actually have to do therapeutic window monitoring for cyclosporin, which can be a little cumbersome. But it is an option for sure. Etretinate. I actually really love etretinate. I think that's it's a really great drug that's underutilized. The problem with it is that it's a very, very, very lipophilic molecule. And what that means is that it already has a really long half-life. It's almost like 190 days, something like that. And if a patient takes one single sip of alcohol, it now doubles that half-life to like 384 days or something crazy. And what that means is that patients who are of childbearing potential should never take this because it's a teratogenic medication. If it's going to take over a year to get out of their system, that's almost impossible to monitor. So it's only for patients who are no longer of childbearing potential and for, basically male patients. Now we get into kind of the tougher ones. Adding apremilast. I've actually been able to do this because I had a bunch of samples. and actually it works very nicely. The problem is with it is that getting coverage. So getting two medications like this covered, which sometimes it's difficult to just get one, can really be problematic. But, and also, apremilast has possible GI side effects, especially during induction. They can have really severe GI distress. I think the PI says that they can lose like up to 10% of their body weight, which is pretty crazy, and that's usually through diarrhea. That's not what it says on the product insert, but that's actually through how it happens. And then also, depression is something that can happen with this medication, so it has to be monitored really closely. Adding a second biologic. I've never been able to do this. It's a great theory. It can definitely have a synergistic approach. You can have two different classes, and they can work in two different ways and really kind of calm down those cytokines. But with that synergy, definitely comes a little bit more risk. You have two side effect profiles to worry about rather than just one. So that's something that needs to be really kind of teased out as well. And obviously, the biggest elephant in that room is insurance. Insurance probably is going to say absolutely not, but it is something that if you can get it, then enjoy it. And I always refer my patients with joint symptoms to rheumatology. I just like that kind of added level of security. I like the kind of collaborative approach with rheumatology to make sure that if they are having joint symptoms, they're doing well. Dr. Amin, he's a professor at Northwestern. He was here a couple days ago. He's a great guy, and he has a really unique clinic where he works. He actually goes into the physical room with his rheumatology colleague, and they talk to this specific patient about how they're going to manage their skin and their joints. And I asked him, I was like, so if I'm seeing these patients who have sometimes significant joint disease, do you feel like it's okay to immediately put them on a biologic medication? And then a couple of months later, they're seeing rheumatology. And he says, I do that all the time. He's like, it's impossible to get these patients into rheumatology, so let's get them treated. And he treats more to symptoms rather than, specific x-ray. So it's something that I've kind of started to do a little bit more in my own practice as well. This was a really interesting article that came out last year in the JAD. It's basically serial biologic therapies in psoriasis. It was a 12-year kind of retrospective study. And really, the crux of the study basically showed that switching between biologic classes yielded longer drug survival than switching within biologic classes. What that basically means is that they found that if you switch out of the class, you're going to have a tendency to actually stay on medication longer than if you switched within a class. They did not tease out enough, I think, to really say exactly why that is, but they just found that the data did kind of support that. These are some references for you guys. And that's my dog Gatsby. Thank you. So I think I'm early. What questions do you have? And Rachel's going to come by with a microphone. I apologize for that.
Hey, Chris. I had a question as some of the biologic reps will talk about radiographic findings versus like the fact that the ACR was used as the guideline for people getting the psoriatic arthritis indication. Mm-hmm. So can you kind of expand on what you just said about using the patient symptoms versus radiographic changes?
Absolutely. So thank you for the question. And this is actually something that this is a theory, and this is not fully sussed out yet. So I have to preface this by saying this. But basically, the theory states that if you have inflammation and it's clinically relevant enough to actually cause pain, if you are able to suppress that pain enough using a biologic medication or sometimes methotrexate, it's very likely that the patient is not going to continue to progress to have worsening symptoms. And that's not to say that you shouldn't be, you know, checking radiographs and, you know, making sure that everything is working well. And I still will send these patients to rheumatology so that they can follow them. But basically, you know, Dr. Amin, and I kind of agree with this, says that if a patient is doing well and their pain symptoms are reducing, it's very likely that their joint symptoms are actually doing well as well. There was another question up front. No?
I'm wondering for some of my patients, particularly on TALTS, after some time on it, they start to flare, and I'm finding that they need their every 2 week dosing again. And I know that the company did do studies that showed safety with Q14-day dosing through 52 weeks. I'm wondering what everybody else is doing. Are you fighting the battle to do that for every 2 weeks through insurance, or do you just change classes at that point?
It's a very good question. I will try to fight that battle. I have tried to fight that battle with specifically that medication and as well as others. And it's a bit of a crapshoot. And usually it's not in your favor. That's the tough part. And sometimes I have to wave the right white flag and then we have to move to another medication. In that case though, I would either probably try one of these assays and see where they are with autoantibody formation, and then see what that susses out. And then if there is no autoantibody formation, I would probably stay within the class. That would be the way I would do it usually. Yes, there's another question for it.
For the Otezla biologic patients, do you tend to get them off of Otezla at some point, or do they stay on both forever?
It depends on if you think the patient is actually in a long-term flare or if they're actually failing medication. And that in itself can be tough to figure out. You know, if a patient is doing really well on a specific biologic and all of a sudden they're really falling off the charts, then maybe it is worth kind of bridging them with apremilast and saying, you know, let's see how this goes for the next few months if we can get it covered. And if you can slowly kind of taper them off or have them stop cold turkey and see if their flare comes back, if that's the case, I would probably move off medication. Any other questions? All right, well, thank you all so much. I hope you have a great rest of your time in LA. Have a great rest of your day today.